I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The governors of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California have committed to sending around 2,000 National Guard members to the U.S.-Mexico border. That's in response to a call to action by President Trump, who says there's been an uptick in illegal border crossings and drug trafficking. Troops are arriving, but operations are not yet fully underway. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame has more.
Maria Reyes lives in Mercedes, Texas, just a couple miles from the banks of the Rio Grande. A gravel road leads to her home on a shaded property squeezed between the river's floodplain and a nature preserve. Reyes is no stranger to the U.S. Border Patrol. They park their vehicles nearby and walk the perimeter of her property. Reyes's dog, Butch, is so used to their presence that he doesn't even bark.
I've seen them practically every day at different times.
She says it's been several months since she encountered someone on her property who'd crossed over illegally. But she remains open to the idea of National Guard members along the border.
They're doing what they're told to do. I think their way of helping is just making sure that nobody crosses or whatever and telling the Border Patrol what's happening. I have no problem with that.
The Rio Grande Valley, where Reyes lives, accounts for 43% of the marijuana pounds seized along the border. Border Patrol Chief Manuel Padilla says he's seen a concerning increase in gang member crossings, tractor-trailer smuggling incidents, and stash houses since March of last year. He spoke in the border town of Weslaco about what he called a chaotic border environment and said Border Patrol doesn't have enough resources to counter the threat.
So we do not have control. Let me be very, very clear on that, right? We do a great job as an agency, as an interagency partner, but at the end of the day, we still have a lot of traffic.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, enthusiastically supports President Trump's plan to secure the border. He defended the mission in a briefing with National Guard troops.
This operation is necessary in order to deal with what has been an escalation of cross-border traffic.
The National Guard doesn't have the authority to make arrests. Instead, they'll support Border Patrol operations by clearing roads, maintaining vehicles, and providing air surveillance. Others may help out at ports of entry. But for some in the Rio Grande Valley, the Guard's presence is puzzling or downright unwelcome. Organizers from the immigrant aid organization La Unión del Pueblo Entero gathered to protest what they call militarization of the border. This is a border zone, not a war zone, they chanted. John Michael Torres was among them. He's seen past National Guard deployments to the area and says they free up Border Patrol and create opportunities for abuse.
You know, they don't have a whole lot to do. If we keep giving them resources, they're going to find things to do, and part of that is going to be harassing our members of the members of our community.
In the past, he says, that's caused border residents to lie low and put a damper on the economy.
A lot of people wouldn't go out unless they had to. They stopped living vibrantly in their communities. People weren't doing the things that they normally would do to spending money, right? Going out.
A short drive north of the border, Xavier Reyes prepares drinks behind the counter of Weslaco's Daily Grind, a coffee shop that draws a mixed crowd of snowbirds and locals. Reyes has lived in Weslaco his whole life. He says he's already noticed a few National Guard members thirsting for caffeine.
We've had a couple of them show up into the coffee house, but nothing major. I haven't seen a lot of traffic.
He says he doesn't have a strong opinion about the National Guard deployment, but he worries that attitudes in the country are turning against immigrants.
I hear a lot like, oh, they come over here, they steal our jobs, you know, or they're doing this and that. I just feel maybe there's a lack of empathy and understanding going on right now, and I don't think it's going to end well.
For now, the National Guard continues its mobilization along the border. Carson Frame, Texas Public Radio News.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Bob Woodruff Foundation. The Texas Sanctuary City Ban, known as SB4, allows police to question the immigration status of any person they detain or arrest. Law enforcement officials must also cooperate with federal immigration officials and honor detainer requests from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. SB4 was actively opposed by some Texas cities, including San Antonio, Austin, and Houston, and they entered into a lawsuit against the state to prove the law's unconstitutionality. However, some cities and counties are actively partnering with ICE to enforce immigration within their jurisdictions under a program known as 287G. Tarrant County entered that partnership last year. KERA's Christopher Connolly takes us to a recent forum on the issue by the Fort Worth Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Luncheons at the posh downtown Fort Worth Club are usually schmoozy affairs. Business leaders and elected officials chatting over white tablecloths. This luncheon, though, had a serious tone, focused on how law enforcement is responding to hardline immigration policies coming from Austin and Washington. Joel Fitzgerald is the Fort Worth police chief.
I don't use terms like undocumented citizen or whatever. I use community. And we are we're charged with protecting our community, no matter who is a part of the community, no matter what status they're in.
Fitzgerald tasked his officers with easing fear among immigrant communities after Texas lawmakers passed SB 4 last year. That law makes it a crime for local officials to not cooperate with federal immigration authorities and authorizes local police to ask about immigration status. Fort Worth is the only large city in the state that's not suing to block SB 4.
The law is on the books. It is the law, and we are charged with enforcing law. However, the voice of the community has to be heard.
Tarrant County Sheriff Bill Wayborn says the fears about the law are unfounded.
Texas peace officers are not out enforcing immigration laws on the street.
They are, however, enforcing the law in Tarrant County's jail. Shortly after he was elected in 2016, Wayborn applied for his department to be part of the so-called 287G program. That allows his officers in the local jail to help immigration and customs enforcement by detaining undocumented immigrants. Wayborn says they're focused on people arrested for serious crimes.
We're going after the child molester. We're going after the murder suspect. We're going after the cartel member. We're going after, yes, the DWI.
Protesters from the immigrant rights group United Fort Worth were in the room, and they had a different take.
I know that there's a lot of rooms about.
7G erodes the trust with the community. Immigration is a federal responsibility.
Interrupting the sheriff, they unfurled a banner that said Sheriff Wayborn separates families. Then they were escorted out of the room.
27G is against us, okay? Up, up with liberation, down, down with deportation. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
Outside the Fort Worth Club, there were more United Fort Worth protesters. They said the 287G program leaves immigrant communities less safe because people are afraid to come forward to report crimes and seek help.
It's voluntary. It's not law like SB 4. It's a voluntary program that the county and the sheriff decided to be a part of.
Daniel Garcia Rodriguez co-founded the organization.
And now there's layers on layers and layers on of worry, of mistrust, of miscommunication. And it just puts a huge burden on the backs of our communities.
75 communities across the country are part of 287G. Garcia Rodriguez says Tarrant County shouldn't be one of them. Christopher Connolly, KERA News.
When we come back, English professor Stephen Alvarez talks about the kind of research that goes into building the college course, Taco Literacy.
When I started reading more about the history of Mexican food, it put me in contact with things I think I knew already, but I couldn't articulate, and things that I lived through, which I never really thought further about.
Fronteras will be back right after this break. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome back to Fronteras. An LA-based artist has been painting a mural in the West Texas border town of Presidio. As Marfa Public Radio's Bela Metzger reports, the mural was a gift from the Mexican government, and its design is meant for both sides of the border.
On the highest hill on the north side of Presidio, I'm in a boom lift, 10 stories up with Miles McGregor.
I'm known as El Mac.
Or Mac, to his friends. Mac's up here spray painting the town's water tower. It used to say Presidio on it, but over the last couple of weeks, a new image has revealed itself. It's of an abuela, a Mexican grandmother holding a rose. Mac says he based the mural on a woman he met here in Presidio named Linda.
She comes from Ojinaga. She has a little store where she sells clothes and stuff. She worked to help put her kids through college.
Linda seemed to exemplify many people in this area who cross back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico all the time. It's just part of living on the border. Mac liked that her face looked maternal, because life down here in the hot, dry Chihuahua desert can be pretty harsh.
Painting an image that is something softer, more welcoming, more feminine just seemed appropriate.
The idea of redesigning the water tank came up back in December. The Mexican consulate approached Presidio's city council with an idea. They wanted to paint a mural. Consul Francisco Jacobi didn't have a design yet, but he said that the sense of the painting would be, quote, that migrants are part of the community. Migrants are welcome.
And of course, the first question is, what's it going to cost us? Believe it or not, this hadn't cost us a dime.
That's Brad Newton, who works for the city of Presidio. He says the Mexican government chose Presidio out of 50 possible locations. Presidio has the smallest, most remote Mexican consulate, but it has a really tight relationship with its neighbor to the south. Presidio and Ojinaga, Mexico collaborate a lot on environmental issues, like when the Rio Grande floods, or when there are emergencies, like fires. And next month, a major bridge expansion project will double the car lanes going between the two towns. Max take?
People are so intermixed that further separating the two sides seems unnecessary and even offensive.
On the other side of the border, in Ojinaga, Mexico, Carlos Franca has been watching the mural's progress. Franca actually lives in Presidio, but he crosses into Mexico every day to work in his family's grocery store. The mural can be seen from the entrance of the store.
It reminds me of my grandmother's. I mean, it looks like a lot of people from around here, I would say, in Presidio and Ojinaga.
Mac isn't surprised that the mural is reminding people of their own grandmothers. He says that when it's done, the painting won't really be of Linda in Presidio, but a composite of abuelas that he's met all around the world. And when he finishes the mural and leaves Presidio, he'll take the people he's met here with him.
I might end up painting the panadero from here in some other city or country, so it kind of just continues. And the same way people migrate, the murals migrate too.
The next time you visit Presidio, look for the abuela up on the water tower. She'll be watching over people on both sides of the border. In Presidio, I'm Bela Metzger.
Tacos. Next to water and oil, it's a topic that's testy enough to start wars. Corn or flour, rolled or folded, soft or crispy or puffy. And most importantly, where is the real home of the breakfast taco? San Antonio and Austin are still fighting it out. It practically requires a deep dive college course to get into the complexities of everybody's favorite handheld food. And that's exactly what Stephen Alvarez has done. Alvarez is an assistant professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. He teaches a course called Taco Literacy. This native of Safford, Arizona, was introduced to a greater diversity of Latin Americans when he pursued his studies in New York. He eventually found himself teaching in Kentucky, which is predominantly Anglo. Alvarez wanted to find commonalities between his culture and that of his students, so he introduced a brand new course. You're teaching a course called Taco Literacy, which sounds like a really sexy elective to take. You know, you put it on the calendar and every kid's going, I'm going to take that one. But it actually goes beyond that. It's, I think, an exploration of the journey of immigrants told through food. Is that correct?
Everything you said, all the above. I should back up just a little bit. In Kentucky, at University of Kentucky, I was teaching classes to, as I mentioned before, mostly white students about the changes that were happening in the South and even in their city. So it was really classes that were geared to thinking about immigration and language diversity, but I also included a unit about food. And I took the students out to a local taqueria, and their eyes were just growing wide when they were looking at the menu and they saw all these choices they had not seen before at places like Taco Bell, Cecina, Al Pastor, Lengua. I mean, you name it, Cabeza. That one really blew their mind. So, you know, when they were eating the tacos, which had handmade corn tortillas. They had so many questions about how tortillas are made and all the like. And really, I was thinking all the stuff I was doing about migration, language, and honoring communities could happen through food. And it was pretty profound. So I thought, why not teach a whole class about Mexican food with. And that's really where it started.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the food. Take, for example, I come from El Paso. I've only been in San Antonio for a little over a year. And anybody from El Paso who comes to San Antonio is going to be like, those aren't tacos. They're on a flour tortilla. Why aren't they on a corn tortilla? Or if they look at a, you know, at a Taco Bell style crispy corn tortilla or the old El Paso type taco shells, those aren't considered real tacos either. So sort of take us back into Mexico. And if you can maybe tell us a little bit about how the taco has maybe evolved as it's crossed the border and moved into various regions of North America.
Yeah, I mean, everything you just mentioned is part of taco literacy, understanding that different regional variations exist and to be able to point out those variations. For example, a breakfast taco versus a breakfast burrito or the San Diego burrito versus the one you would find in San Francisco. All are examples of really thinking about how Mexican-American food has really grown, really from the roots of Mexico. And if we really want to go back to it, I mean, it all comes back to the tortilla. And the tortilla itself is really fascinating to understand the variations between flour tortillas in the north versus corn tortillas in the southern part of Mexico. And how these, of course, evolved in the United States to become things like burritos and really the kind of fast food that we understand today. Now, in the taco, I think as long as there's been tortillas, there's been things to put inside of them, and it's hard to find if there is the origin of taco, but we understand that it was a food of the working folks on the go, and really a kind of food that you could eat standing up, and maybe that's where the word taco comes from heel, but it was a working class food. And in the United States, the ones that really took off were, we understand, as tacos dorados, and they really took off in San Bernardino, where Glenn Bell set up the Taco Bell empire, but also the same town where McDonald's got its start. Really, the kind of startups of fast food blew up in Southern California and not only took over the United States, but took over the world. Well, Glenn Bell used to hang out at this spot across from his restaurant, the Mitla Cafe, where he saw that Mexican food was doing quite well. Lines were out the door for people who wanted to have some tacos. So he had the idea that he could do a fast food version of Mexican food. Now, this is often what gets understood as American Mexican food, but really I think it falls under the classification of fast food in general, which is inherently American.
So it's interesting. What kind of research did you have to do in order to gain this knowledge about tacos? Was it just eating a lot of tacos everywhere that you could?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, that's one of the joys of this research. It's stuff I grew up with as Mexican American in Arizona. I tell this story where I remember being very young and sitting across from my mom when she was making flour tortillas with, you know, manteca and flour and rolling the balls. And she would give me some of the balls to roll myself. And then she would flip them on the comal. The stack would grow higher and higher. And I'd add a tortilla and butter every once in a while. Maybe several, actually. Oftentimes when I'd seen my grandparents, it was always eat, come, come, Stevie, they would say. And that's where I had arroz con leche for the first time, something my grandma would make. With the cinnamon stick and birria and just all the different kinds of foods that I didn't appreciate at the time. Starting school, my mom would give me bean burros. In southern Arizona, we don't call them burritos, we call them burros. And going to school, having that in my lunch, and kids would tease me. You know, they would call me euphemisms for people who are undocumented for what I was eating. And just having that kind of shame and asking my mom just to give me a sandwich instead so I wouldn't be teased anymore. These things were all part of the food and the culture of being Mexican-American. And when I started reading more about the history of Mexican food, it just, I guess it put me in contact with things I think I knew already, but I couldn't articulate. And things that I lived through, which I never really thought further about. And sometimes we don't really think about what we're putting in our body, but we really should. And we should also appreciate the history and the hands that were involved in putting that food at our table.
And so before I ask my final question, I, like you, have enjoyed a really great flour tortilla with butter on it. Nothing better. I've also enjoyed, you know, like just a corn tortilla with a little salt in it. And that's, again, a beautiful thing. But for you, what is your preference, flour or corn?
Oh, man, so many choose. I was in the South recently. They had a question about cornbread or biscuits. And my response is, why can't we have both? You know, they each have their function. But if you're going to ask me that, I have to say always it's what's been closest at my heart. And it's the one that I remember, you know, my mom flipping on the comal. These are the very light flour tortillas that come from southern Arizona and northern Sonora. Hermosillo is really famous for them. Not quite as big as the huge ones that you might be familiar with, sabacarias. They're like the ones that they say, they stretch them, they go into the sabacos, into the armpits. Not quite those, but just the very light, fluffy flour tortilla is the one I'm always going to be very happy with. In Safford, Arizona, we have a tortilla factory, Mi Casa Tortillas. And those are the ones I bring back en masse to New York, usually 7 or 8 packs of dozens when I come back on the airplane. So oftentimes I have a suitcase just of tortillas.
Stephen Alvarez is an assistant professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. He teaches a course called Taco Literacy, which explores the foodways of Mexican immigrants in the U.S. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.